Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from the Treasury of American Short Stories, edited by Nancy Sullivan. Welcome to the Monkey House by Kurt Vonnegut, Jr. So Pete Crocker, the sheriff of Barnstable County, which was the whole of Cape Cod, came into the federal ethical suicide parlor in Hyannis one May afternoon, and he told the 2 6-foot hostesses there that they weren't to be alarmed, but that a notorious nothinghead named Billy the Poet was believed headed for the Cape. A nothinghead was a person who refused to take his ethical birth control pills 3 times a day. The penalty for that was $10,000 and 10 years in jail. This was at a time when the population on Earth was 17 billion human beings. That was far too many mammals that big for a planet that small. The people were virtually packed together like drupelets. Drupelets are the pulpy little knobs that compose the outside of a raspberry. So the world government was making a 2-pronged attack on overpopulation. One pronging was the encouragement of ethical suicide, which consisted of going to the nearest suicide parlor and asking a hostess to kill you painlessly while you lay on a Barca lounger. The other pronging was compulsory ethical birth control. The sheriff told the hostesses, who were pretty, tough-minded, highly intelligent girls, that roadblocks were being set up and house-to-house searches were being conducted to catch Billy the Poet. The main difficulty was that the police didn't know what he looked like. The few people who had seen him and known him for what he was were women, and they disagreed fantastically as to his height, his hair color, his voice, his weight, the color of his skin. "I don't need to remind you girls," the sheriff went on, "that a nothinghead is very sensitive from the waist down. If Billy the Poet somehow slips in here and starts making trouble, one good kick in the right place will do wonders." He was referring to the fact that the ethical birth control pills, the only legal form of birth control, made people numb from the waist down. Most men said their bottom halves felt like cold iron or balsa wood. Most women said their bottom halves felt like wet cotton or stale ginger ale. The pills were so effective that you could blindfold a man who had taken one, tell him to recite the Gettysburg Address, kick him in the balls while he was doing it, and he wouldn't miss a syllable. The pills were ethical because they didn't interfere with a person's ability to reproduce, which would have been unnatural and immoral. All the pills did was take every bit of pleasure out of sex. Thus did science and morals go hand in hand. The 2 hostesses there in Hyannis were Nancy McLuhan and Mary Kraft. Nancy was a strawberry blonde. Mary was a glossy brunette. Their uniforms were white lipstick, heavy eye makeup, purple body stockings with nothing underneath, and black leather boots. They ran a small operation with only 6 suicide booths. In a really good week, say the one before Christmas, they might put 60 people to sleep. It was done with a hypodermic syringe. "My main message to you girls," said Sheriff Crocker, "is that everything's well under control. You can just go about your business here." "Didn't you leave out part of your main message?" Nancy asked him. "I don't get you. I didn't hear you say he was probably headed straight for us." He shrugged in clumsy innocence. "We don't know that for sure." "I thought that was all anybody did know about Billy the Poet, that he specializes in deflowering hostesses in ethical suicide parlors." Nancy was a virgin. All hostesses were virgins. They also had to hold advanced degrees in psychology and nursing. They also had to be plump and rosy and at least 6 feet tall. America had changed in many ways, but it had yet to adopt the metric system. Nancy McLuhan was burned up that the sheriff would try to protect her and Mary from the full truth about Bill the Poet, as though they might panic if they heard it. She told the sheriff so. "How long do you think a girl would last in the ESS," she said, meaning the Ethical Suicide Service, "if she scared that easy?" The sheriff took a step backward, pulled in his chin. "Not very long, I guess." "That's very true," said Nancy, closing the distance between them and offering him a sniff of the edge of her hand, which was poised for a karate chop. All hostesses were experts at judo and karate. "If you'd like to find out how helpless we are, just come toward me, pretending you're Billy the Poet." The sheriff shook his head, gave her a glassy smile. "I'd rather not." "That's the smartest thing you've said today," said Nancy, turning her back on him while Mary laughed. "We're not scared. We're angry. Or we're not even that. He isn't worth that. We're bored." How boring that he should come a great distance, should cause all this fuss in order to... She let the sentence die there. It's just too absurd. I'm not as mad at him as I am at the women who let him do it to them without a struggle, said Mary, who let him do it and then couldn't tell the police what he looked like. Suicide hostesses at that. Somebody hasn't been keeping up with her karate, said Nancy. It wasn't just Billy the Poet who was attracted to hostesses and ethical suicide parlors. All nothing heads were. Bombed out of their skulls with the sex madness that came from taking nothing, they thought the white lips and big eyes and body stocking and boots of a hostess spelled sex, sex, sex. The truth was, of course, that sex was the last thing any hostess ever had in mind. If Billy follows his usual M.O., said the sheriff, he'll study your habits and the neighborhood, and then he'll pick one or the other of you and he'll send her a dirty poem in the mail. Charming, said Nancy. He has also been known to use the telephone. How brave, said Nancy. Over the sheriff's shoulder she could see the mailman coming. A blue light went on over the door of a booth for which Nancy was responsible. The person in there wanted something. It was the only booth in use at the time. The sheriff asked her if there was a possibility that the person in there was Billy the Poet, and Nancy said, "Well, if it is, I can break his neck with my thumb and forefinger." "Foxy Grandpa," said Mary, who'd seen him too. A foxy grandpa was any old man, cute and senile, who quibbled and joked and reminisced for hours before he let a hostess put him to sleep. Nancy groaned. "We've spent the past 2 hours trying to decide on a last meal." And then the mailman came in with just one letter. It was addressed to Nancy in smeary pencil. She was splendid with anger and disgust as she opened it, knowing it would be a piece of filth from Billy. She was right. Inside the envelope was a poem. It wasn't an original poem. It was a song from olden days that had taken on new meaning since the numbness of ethical birth control had become universal. It went like this, in smeary pencil again. "We were walking through the park, a-goosing statues in the dark. If Sherman's horse can take it, so can you." When Nancy came into the suicide booth to see what he wanted, the foxy grandpa was lying on the mint-green barca lounger where hundreds had died so peacefully over the years. He was studying the menu from the Howard Johnson's next door and beating time to the muzak coming from the loudspeaker on the lemon-yellow wall. The room was painted cinder block. There was one barred window with a Venetian blind. There was a Howard Johnson's next door to every ethical suicide parlor and vice versa. The Howard Johnson's had an orange roof and the suicide parlor had a purple roof, but they were both the government. Practically everything was the government. Practically everything was automated, too. Nancy and Mary and the sheriff were lucky to have jobs. Most people didn't. The average citizen moped around home and watched television, which was the government. Every 15 minutes his television would urge him to vote intelligently or consume intelligently or worship in the church of his choice or love his fellow men or obey the laws or pay a call to the nearest ethical suicide parlor and find out how friendly and understanding a hostess could be. The foxy grandpa was something of a rarity since he was marked by old age, was bald, was shaky, had spots on his hands. Most people looked 22 thanks to anti-aging shots they took twice a year. That the old man looked old was proof that the shots had been discovered after his sweet bird of youth had flown. "Have we decided on a last supper yet?" Nancy asked him. She heard peevishness in her own voice, heard herself betray her exasperation with Billy the Poet, her boredom with the old man. She was ashamed, for this was unprofessional of her. "The breaded veal cutlet is very good." The old man cocked his head. With the greedy cunning of second childhood, he had caught her being unprofessional, unkind, and he was going to punish her for it. "You don't sound very friendly. I thought you were all supposed to be friendly. I thought this was supposed to be a pleasant place to come." "I beg your pardon," she said. "If I seem unfriendly, it has nothing to do with you. I thought maybe I bored you." "No, no," she said gamely, "not at all. You certainly know some very interesting history. Among other things, the foxy grandpa claimed to have known J. Edgar Nation, the Grand Rapids druggist who was the father of ethical birth control." "Then look like you're interested," he told her. He could get away with that sort of impudence. The thing was, he could leave any time he wanted to, right up to the moment he asked for the needle, and he had to ask for the needle. That was the law. Nancy's art and the art of every hostess was to see that volunteers didn't leave, to coax and wheedle and flatter them patiently every step of the way. So Nancy had to sit down there in the booth to pretend to marvel at the freshness of the yarn the old man told, a story everybody knew about how J. Edgar Nation happened to experiment with ethical birth control. He didn't have the slightest idea his pills would be taken by human beings someday, said the foxy grandpa. His dream was to introduce morality into the monkey house at the Grand Rapids Zoo. Did you realize that? He inquired severely. No, no, I didn't. That's very interesting. He and his 11 kids went to church one Easter, and the day was so nice and the Easter service had been so beautiful and pure that they decided to take a walk through the zoo, and they were just walking on clouds. The scene described was lifted from a play that was performed on television every Easter. The foxy grandpa shoehorned himself into the scene, had himself chat with the nations just before they got to the monkey house. Good morning, Mr. Nation, I said to him. It certainly is a nice morning. And a good morning to you, Mr. Howard, he said to me. There is nothing like an Easter morning to make a man feel clean and reborn and at one with God's intentions. Nancy could hear the telephone ringing faintly, naggingly, through the nearly soundproof door. So we went on to the monkey house together, and what do you think we saw? I can't imagine. Somebody had answered the phone. We saw a monkey playing with his private parts. No. Yes, and J. Edgar Nation was so upset he went straight home and he started developing a pill that would make monkeys in the springtime fit things for a Christian family to see. There was a knock on the door. Yes, said Nancy. Nancy, said Mary, telephone for you. When Nancy came out of the booth, she found the sheriff choking on little squeals of law enforcement delight. The telephone was tapped by agents hidden in the Howard Johnsons. Billy the Poet was believed to be on the line. His call had been traced. Police were already on their way to grab him. Keep him on, keep him on, the sheriff whispered to Nancy, and he gave her the telephone as though it were solid gold. Yes, said Nancy. Nancy McLuhan, said a man. His voice was disguised. He might have been speaking through a kazoo. I'm calling for a mutual friend. Oh? He asked me to deliver a message. I see. It's a poem. All right. Ready? Ready. Nancy could hear sirens screaming in the background of the call. The caller must have heard the sirens, too, but he recited the poem without any emotion. It went like this. Soak yourself in Jergens lotion. Here comes the one-man population explosion. They got him. Nancy heard it all, the thumping and clumping, the argle, bargle, and cries. The depression she felt as she hung up was glandular. Her brave body had prepared for a fight that was not to be. The sheriff bounded out of the suicide parlor in such a hurry to see the famous criminal he'd helped catch that a sheaf of papers fell from the pocket of his trench coat. Mary picked them up, called after the sheriff. He halted for a moment, said the papers didn't matter anymore, asked her if maybe she wouldn't like to come along. There was a flurry between the two girls, with Nancy persuading Mary to go, declaring that she had no curiosity about Billy. So Mary left, irrelevantly handing the sheaf to Nancy. The sheaf proved to be photocopies of poems Billy had sent to hostesses in other places. Nancy read the top one. It made much of a peculiar side effect of ethical birth control pills. They not only made people numb, they also made people piss blue. The poem was called What the Something Head Said to the Suicide Hostess, and it went like this. I did not sew, I did not spin, and thanks to pills I did not sin. I loved the crowds, the stink, the noise, and when I peed turquoise. I ate beneath a roof of orange, swung with progress like a door hinge. Neath purple roof I've come today to piss my azure life away. Virgin hostess, death's recruiter, life is cute, but you are cuter. Mourn, my pecker, purple daughter, all it passed was sky-blue water. You never heard that story before about how J. Edgar Nation came to invent ethical birth control? The foxy grandpa wanted to know. His voice cracked. Never did, lied Nancy. I thought everybody knew that. It was news to me. When he got through with the monkey house, you couldn't tell it from the Michigan Supreme Court. Meanwhile, there was this crisis going on in the United Nations. The people who understood science said people had to quit reproducing so much, and the people who understood morals said society would collapse if people used sex for nothing but pleasure. The foxy grandpa got off his barca lounger, went over to the window, pried two slats of the blind apart. There wasn't much to see out there. The view was blocked by the backside of a mocked-up thermometer 20 feet high, which faced the street. It was calibrated in billions of people on Earth, from 0 to 20. The make-believe column of liquid was a strip of translucent red plastic. It showed how many people there were on Earth. Very close to the bottom was a black arrow that showed what the scientists thought the population ought to be. The foxy grandpa was looking at the setting sun through that red plastic and through the blind, too, so that his face was banded with shadows and red. "Tell me," he said, "when I die, how much will that thermometer go down? A foot? No. An inch? Not quite." "You know what the answer is, don't you?" he said, and he faced her. The senility had vanished from his voice and eyes. 1 inch on that thing equals 83,333 people. You knew that, didn't you?" That might be true," said Nancy, "but that isn't the right way to look at it, in my opinion." He didn't ask her what the right way was, in her opinion. He completed a thought of his own instead. "I'll tell you something else that's true. I'm Billy the Poet, and you're a very good-looking woman." With one hand he drew a snub-nosed revolver from his belt. With the other he peeled off his bald dome and wrinkled forehead, which proved to be rubber. Now he looked 22. "The police will want to know exactly what I look like when this is all over," he told Nancy with a malicious grin. "In case you're not good at describing people, and it's surprising how many women aren't. I'm 5'2", with eyes of blue, with brown hair to my shoulders. A manly elf, so full of self, the ladies say he smolders." Billy was 10 inches shorter than Nancy was. She had about 40 pounds on him. She told him he didn't have a chance, but Nancy was much mistaken. He had unbolted the bars on the window the night before, and he had made her go out the window and then down a manhole that was hidden from the street by the big thermometer. He took her down into the sewers of Hyannis. He knew where he was going. He had a flashlight and a map. Nancy had to go before him along the narrow catwalk, her own shadow dancing mockingly in the lead. She tried to guess where they were relative to the real world above. She guessed correctly when they passed under the Howard Johnsons, guessed from noises she heard. The machinery that processed and served the food there was silent. But, so people wouldn't feel too lonesome when eating there, the designers had provided sound effects for the kitchen. It was these, Nancy heard, a tape recording of the clashing of silverware and the laughter of Negroes and Puerto Ricans. After that, she was lost. Billy had very little to say to her other than right or left, or don't try anything funny, Juno, or I'll blow your great big fucking head off. Only once did they have anything resembling a conversation. Billy began it and ended it, too. "What in hell is a girl with hips like yours doing selling death?" he asked her from behind. She dared to stop. "I can answer that," she told him. She was confident that she could give him an answer that would shrivel him like napalm. But he gave her a shove, offered to blow her fucking head off again. "You don't even want to hear my answer," she taunted him. "You're afraid to hear it." "I never listen to a woman till the pills wear off," sneered Billy. That was his plan, then, to keep her a prisoner for at least 8 hours. That was how long it took for the pills to wear off. "That's a silly rule. A woman's not a woman till the pills wear off. You certainly managed to make a woman feel like an object rather than a person." "Thank the pills for that," said Billy. There were 80 miles of sewers under Greater Hyannis, which had a population of 400,000 druplets, 400,000 souls. Nancy lost track of the time down there. When Billy announced that they had at last reached their destination, it was possible for Nancy to imagine that a year had passed. She tested this spooky impression by pinching her own thigh, by feeling what the chemical clock of her body said. Her thigh was still numb. Billy ordered her to climb iron rungs that were set in wet masonry. There was a circle of sickly light above. It proved to be moonlight filtered through the plastic polygons of an enormous geodesic dome. Nancy didn't have to ask the traditional victim's question, "Where am I?" There was only one dome like that on Cape Cod. It was in Hyannisport, and it sheltered the ancient Kennedy compound. It was a museum of how life had been in more expansive times. The museum was closed. It was open only in the summertime. The manhole from which Nancy and then Billy emerged was set in an expanse of green cement, which showed where the Kennedy lawn had been. On the green cement in front of the ancient frame houses were statues representing the 14 Kennedys who had been presidents of the United States of the world. They were playing touch football. The president of the world at the time of Nancy's abduction, incidentally, was an ex-suicide hostess named Ma Kennedy. Her statue would never join this particular touch football game. Her name was Kennedy, all right, but she wasn't the real thing. People complained of her lack of style, found her vulgar. On the wall of her office was a sign that said, "You don't have to be crazy to work here, but it sure helps," and another one that said, "Thimpk," and another one that said, "Someday we're going to have to get organized around here." Her office was in the Taj Mahal. Until she arrived in the Kennedy Museum, Nancy McLuhan was confident that she would sooner or later get a chance to break every bone in Billy's little body, maybe even shoot him with his own gun. She wouldn't have minded doing those things. She thought he was more disgusting than a blood-filled tick. It wasn't compassion that changed her mind. It was the discovery that Billy had a gang. There were at least 8 people around the manhole, men and women in equal numbers, with stockings pulled over their heads. It was the women who laid firm hands on Nancy, told her to keep calm. They were all at least as tall as Nancy, and they held her in places where they could hurt her like hell if they had to. Nancy closed her eyes, but this didn't protect her from the obvious conclusion. These perverted women were sisters from the Ethical Suicide Service. This upset her so much that she asked loudly and bitterly, "How can you violate your oaths like this?" She was promptly hurt so badly that she doubled up and burst into tears. When she straightened up again, there was plenty more she wanted to say, but she kept her mouth shut. She speculated silently as to what on earth could make suicide hostesses turn against every concept of human decency. Nothing headedness alone couldn't begin to explain it. They had to be drugged, besides. Nancy went over in her mind all the terrible drugs she'd learned about in school, persuaded herself that the women had taken the worst one of all. That drug was so powerful, Nancy's teachers had told her, that even a person numb from the waist down would copulate repeatedly and enthusiastically after just one glass. That had to be the answer. The women, and probably the men, too, had been drinking gin. They hastened Nancy into the middle frame house, which was dark like all the rest, and Nancy heard the men giving Billy the news. It was in this news that Nancy perceived a glint of hope. Help might be on its way. The gang member who had phoned Nancy obscenely had fooled the police into believing that they had captured Billy the Poet, which was bad for Nancy. The police didn't know yet that Nancy was missing, 2 men told Billy, and a telegram had been sent to Mary Craft in Nancy's name, declaring that Nancy had been called to New York City on urgent family business. That was where Nancy saw the glint of hope. Mary wouldn't believe that telegram. Mary knew Nancy had no family in New York. Not one of the 63 million people living there was a relative of Nancy's. The gang had deactivated the burglar alarm system of the museum. They had also cut through a lot of the chains and ropes that were meant to keep visitors from touching anything of value. There was no mystery as to who and what had done the cutting. One of the men was armed with brutal lopping shears. They marched Nancy into a servant's bedroom upstairs. The man with the shears cut the ropes that fenced off the narrow bed. They put Nancy into the bed, and 2 men held Nancy while a woman gave her a knockout shot. Billy the Poet had disappeared. As Nancy was going under, the woman who had given her the shot asked her how old she was. Nancy was determined not to answer, but discovered that the drug had made her powerless not to answer. 63, she murmured. How does it feel to be a virgin at 63? Nancy heard her own answer through a velvet fog. She was amazed by the answer, wanted to protest that it couldn't possibly be hers. Pointless, she'd said. Moments later, she asked the woman thickly, what was in that needle? What was in that needle, Honey Bunch? Why, Honey Bunch, they call that truth serum. The moon was down when Nancy woke up, but the night was still out there. The shades were drawn and there was candlelight. Nancy had never seen a lit candle before. What awakened Nancy was a dream of mosquitoes and bees. Mosquitoes and bees were extinct, so were birds. But Nancy dreamed that millions of insects were swarming about her from the waist down. They didn't sting, they fanned her. Nancy was a nothing head. She went to sleep again. When she awoke next time, she was being led into a bathroom by 3 women, still with stockings over their heads. The bathroom was already filled with the steam from somebody else's bath. There were somebody else's wet footprints crisscrossing the floor, and the air reeked of pine needle perfume. Her will and intelligence returned as she was bathed and perfumed and dressed in a white nightgown. When the women stepped back to admire her, she said to them quietly, I may be a nothing head now, but that doesn't mean I have to think like one or act like one. Nobody argued with her. Nancy was taken downstairs and out of the house. She fully expected to be sent down a manhole again. It would be the perfect setting for her violation by Billy, she was thinking, down in a sewer. But they took her across the green cement where the grass used to be, and then across the yellow cement where the beach used to be, and then out onto the blue cement where the harbor used to be. There were 26 yachts that had belonged to various Kennedys, sunk up to their water lines in blue cement. It was to the most ancient of these yachts, the Marlin, once the property of Joseph P. Kennedy, that they delivered Nancy. It was dawn. Because of the high-rise apartments all around the Kennedy Museum, it would be an hour before any direct sunlight would reach the microcosm under the geodesic dome. Nancy was escorted as far as the companionway to the forward cabin of the Marlin. The women pantomimed that she was expected to go down the 5 steps alone. Nancy froze for the moment, and so did the women, and there were 2 actual statues in the tableau on the bridge. Standing at the wheel was a statue of Frank Werdernen, once skipper of the Marlin, and next to him was his son and first mate, Carly. They weren't paying any attention to poor Nancy. They were staring out through the windshield at the blue cement. Nancy, barefoot and wearing a thin white nightgown, descended bravely into the forward cabin, which was a pool of candlelight and pine needle perfume. The companionway hatch was closed and locked behind her. Nancy's emotions and the antique furnishings of the cabin were so complex that Nancy could not at first separate Billy the poet from his surroundings, from all the mahogany and leaded glass. And then she saw him at the far end of the cabin with his back against the door to the forward cockpit. He was wearing purple silk pajamas with a Russian collar. They were piped in red, and writhing across Billy's silken breast was a golden dragon. It was belching fire. Anticlimactically, Billy was wearing glasses. He was holding a book. Nancy poised herself on the next to the bottom step, took a firm grip on the handholds in the companionway. She bared her teeth, calculated that it would take 10 men Billy's size to dislodge her. Between them was a great table. Nancy had expected the cabin to be dominated by a bed, possibly in the shape of a swan, but the Marlin was a day boat. The cabin was anything but a seraglio. It was about as voluptuous as a lower-middle-class dining room in Akron, Ohio, around 1910. A candle was on the table, so were an ice bucket and 2 glasses and a quart of champagne. Champagne was as illegal as heroin. Billy took off his glasses, gave her a shy, embarrassed smile, and said, "Welcome. This is as far as I come." He accepted that. "You're very beautiful there." "And what am I supposed to say, that you're stunningly handsome? That I feel an overwhelming desire to throw myself into your manly arms?" "If you wanted to make me happy, that would certainly be the way to do it." He said that humbly. "And what about my happiness?" The question seemed to puzzle him. "Nancy, that's what this is all about. What if my idea of happiness doesn't coincide with yours? And what do you think my idea of happiness is? I'm not going to throw myself into your arms, and I'm not going to drink that poison, and I'm not going to budge from here unless somebody makes me," said Nancy. "So I think your idea of happiness is going to turn out to be 8 people holding me down on that table while you bravely hold a cocked pistol to my head and do what you want. That's the way it's going to have to be, so call your friends and get it over with," which he did. He didn't hurt her. He deflowered her with a clinical skill she found ghastly. When it was all over, he didn't seem cocky or proud. On the contrary, he was terribly depressed, and he said to Nancy, "Believe me, if there'd been any other way." Her reply to this was a face like stone and silent tears of humiliation. His helpers let down a folding bunk from the wall. It was scarcely wider than a bookshelf and hung on chains. Nancy allowed herself to be put to bed in it, and she was left alone with Billy the poet again. Big as she was, like a double bass wedged on that narrow shelf, she felt like a pitiful little thing. A scratchy, war surplus blanket had been tucked in around her. It was her own idea to pull up a corner of the blanket to hide her face. Nancy sensed from sounds what Billy was doing, which wasn't much. He was sitting at the table, sighing occasionally, sniffing occasionally, turning the pages of a book. He lit a cigar, and the stink of it seeped under the blanket. Billy inhaled the cigar, then coughed and coughed and coughed. When the coughing died down, Nancy said loathingly through the blanket, "You're so strong, so masterful, so healthy. It must be wonderful to be so manly." Billy only sighed at this. "I'm not a very typical nothinghead," she said. "I hated it, hated everything about it." Billy sniffed, turned a page. "I suppose all the other women just loved it, couldn't get enough of it." "Nope." She uncovered her face. "What do you mean, nope? They've all been like you." This was enough to make Nancy sit up and stare at him. "The women who helped you tonight? What about them? You've done to them what you did to me?" He didn't look up from his book. "That's right. Then why don't they kill you instead of helping you?" "Because they understand." And then he added mildly, "They're grateful." Nancy got out of bed, came to the table, gripped the edge of the table, leaned close to him, and she said to him tautly, "I am not grateful." "You will be." "And what could possibly bring about that miracle?" "Time," said Billy. Billy closed his book, stood up. Nancy was confused by his magnetism. Somehow he was very much in charge again. "What you've been through, Nancy," he said, "is a typical wedding night for a straight-laced girl of 100 years ago, when everybody was a nothing-head. The groom did without helpers, because the bride wasn't customarily ready to kill him. Otherwise, the spirit of the occasion was much the same. These are the pajamas my great-great-grandfather wore on his wedding night in Niagara Falls. According to his diary, his bride cried all that night and threw up twice. But with the passage of time, she became a sexual enthusiast." It was Nancy's turn to reply by not replying. She understood the tale. It frightened her to understand so easily that from gruesome beginnings, sexual enthusiasm could grow and grow. "You're a very typical nothing-head," said Billy. "If you dare to think about it now, you'll realize that you're angry because I'm such a bad lover, and a funny-looking shrimp, besides. And what you can't help dreaming about from now on is a really suitable mate for a Juno like yourself. You'll find him, too, tall and strong and gentle. The nothing-head movement is growing by leaps and bounds." "But," said Nancy, and she stopped there. She looked out a porthole at the rising sun. "But what? The world is in the mess it is today because of the nothing-headedness of olden times. Don't you see?" She was pleading weakly. "The world can't afford sex anymore." "Of course it can afford sex," said Billy. "All it can't afford anymore is reproduction." "Then why the laws?" "They're bad laws," said Billy. "If you go back through history, you'll find that the people who have been most eager to rule, to make the laws, to enforce the laws, and to tell everybody exactly how God Almighty wants things here on earth, those people have forgiven themselves and their friends for anything and everything. But they have been absolutely disgusted and terrified by the natural sexuality of common men and women. Why this is, I do not know. That is one of the many questions I wish somebody would ask the machines. I do know this. The triumph of that sort of disgust and terror is now complete. Almost every man and woman looks and feels like something the cat dragged in. The only sexual beauty that an ordinary human being can see today is in the woman who will kill him. Sex is death. There's a short and nasty equation for you. Sex is death. QED. "So you see, Nancy," said Billy, "I have spent this night and many others like it attempting to restore a certain amount of innocent pleasure to the world, which is poorer in pleasure than it needs to be." Nancy sat down quietly and bowed her head. "I'll tell you what my grandfather did on the dawn of his wedding night," said Billy. "I don't think I want to hear it." "It isn't violent. It's meant to be tender. Maybe that's why I don't want to hear it." He read his bride a poem. Billy took the book from the table, opened it. His diary tells which poem it was. "While we aren't bride and groom, and while we may not meet again for many years, I'd like to read this poem to you, to have you know I've loved you." "Please, no, I couldn't stand it." "All right, I'll leave the book here, with the place marked, in case you want to read it later. It's the poem beginning, 'How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach, when feeling out of sight, for the ends of being an ideal grace.'" Billy put a small bottle on top of the book. "I'm also leaving you these pills. If you take one a month, you will never have children, and still you'll be a nothing head." And he left, and they all left but Nancy. When Nancy raised her eyes at last to the book and bottle, she saw that there was a label on the bottle. What the label said was this: "Welcome to the Monkey House." And that story was Welcome to the Monkey House by Kurt Vonnegut Jr. from the Treasury of American Short Stories, edited by Nancy Sullivan. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from the same book, King of the Bingo Game by Ralph Ellison. The woman in front of him was eating roasted peanuts that smelled so good that he could barely contain his hunger. He could not even sleep and wished they'd hurry and begin the bingo game. There on his right, two fellows were drinking wine out of a bottle wrapped in a paper bag, and he could hear soft gurgling in the dark. His stomach gave a low, gnawing growl. If this was down south, he thought, all I'd have to do is lean over and say, "Lady, give me a few of those peanuts, please, ma'am," and she'd pass me the bag and never think nothing of it. Or he could ask the fellows for a drink in the same way. Folks down south stuck together that way. They didn't even have to know you. But up here it was different. Ask somebody for something and they'd think you were crazy. Well, I ain't crazy. I'm just broke, 'cause I got no birth certificate to get a job and Laura about to die 'cause we got no money for a doctor. But I ain't crazy. And yet a pinpoint of doubt was focused in his mind as he glanced toward the screen and saw the hero stealthily entering a dark room and sending the beam of flashlight along a wall of bookcases. This is where he finds the trap door, he remembered. The man would pass abruptly through the wall and find the girl tied to the bed, her legs and arms spread wide and her clothing torn to rags. He laughed softly to himself. He had seen the picture 3 times, and this was one of the best scenes. On his right, the fellow whispered wide-eyed to his companion, "Man, look a-yonder! Damn! Wouldn't I like to have her tied up like that? Hey, that fool's letting her loose! Ah, man, he loves her! Love or no love!" The man moved impatiently beside him, and he tried to involve himself in the scene. But Laura was on his mind. Tiring quickly of watching the picture, he looked back to where the white beam filtered from the projection room above the balcony. It started small and grew large, specks of dust dancing in its whiteness as it reached the screen. It was strange how the beam always landed right on the screen and didn't mess up and fall somewhere else. But they had it all fixed. Everything was fixed. Now suppose when they showed that girl with her dress torn, the girl started taking off the rest of her clothes, and when the guy came in, he didn't untie her but kept her there and went to taking off his own clothes. That would be something to see. If a picture got out of hand like that, those guys up there would go nuts. Yeah, and there'd be so many folks in here you wouldn't find a seat for 9 months. A strange sensation played over his skin. He shuddered. Yesterday he'd seen a bedbug on a woman's neck as they walked out into the bright street. But exploring his thigh through a hole in his pocket, he found only goose pimples and old scars. The bottle gurgled again. He closed his eyes. Now a dreamy music was accompanying the film, and train whistles were sounding in the distance, and he was a boy again, walking along a railroad trestle down south, and seeing the train coming, and running back as fast as he could go, and hearing the whistle blowing, and getting off the trestle to solid ground just in time, with the earth trembling beneath his feet, and feeling relieved as he ran down the cinder-strewn embankment onto the highway, and looking back and seeing with terror that the train had left the track and was following him right down the middle of the street, and all the white people laughing as he ran, screaming. "Wake up there, buddy! What the hell do you mean hollering like that? Can't you see we're trying to enjoy this here picture?" He stared at the man with gratitude. "I'm sorry, old man," he said. "I must have been dreaming." "Well, here, have a drink, and don't be making no noise like that. Damn!" His hands trembled as he tilted his head. It was not wine, but whiskey. Cold rye whiskey. He took a deep swaller, decided it was better not to take another, and handed the bottle back to its owner. "Thanks, old man," he said. Now he felt the cold whiskey breaking a warm path straight through the middle of him, growing hotter and sharper as it moved. He had not eaten all day, and it made him lightheaded. The smell of the peanuts stabbed him like a knife, and he got up and found a seat in the middle aisle. But no sooner did he sit than he saw a row of intense-faced young girls and got up again, thinking, "You chicks must have been lindy-hopping somewhere." He found a seat several rows ahead as the lights came on, and he saw the screen disappear behind a heavy red and gold curtain, then the curtain rising and the man with the microphone and a uniformed attendant coming on the stage. He felt for his bingo card, smiling. The guy at the door wouldn't like it if he knew about his having 5 cards. Well, not everyone played the bingo game, and even with 5 cards he didn't have much of a chance. For Laura, though, he had to have faith. He studied the cards, each with its different numerals, punching the free center hole in each and spreading them neatly across his lap. And when the lights faded, he sat slouched in his seat so that he could look from his cards to the bingo wheel with but a quick shifting of his eyes. Ahead, at the end of the darkness, the man with the microphone was pressing a button attached to a long cord and spinning the bingo wheel and calling out the number each time the wheel came to rest. And each time the voice rang out, his finger raced over the cards for the number. With 5 cards, he had to move fast. He became nervous. There were too many cards, and the man went too fast with his grating voice. Perhaps he should just select one and throw the others away? But he was afraid. He became warm. Wonder how much Laura's doctor would cost. Damn that! Watch the cards! And with despair he heard the man call 3 in a row, which he missed on all 5 cards. This way he'd never win. When he saw the row of holes punched across the 3rd card, he sat paralyzed and heard the man call 3 more numbers before he stumbled forward, screaming, "Bingo! Bingo!" "Let that fool up there," someone called. "Get up here, man." He stumbled down the aisle and up the steps to the stage into a light so sharp and bright that for a moment it blinded him, and he felt that he had moved into the spell of some strange, mysterious power. Yet it was as familiar as the sun, and he knew it was the perfectly familiar bingo. The man with the microphone was saying something to the audience as he held out his card. A cold light flashed from the man's finger as the card left his hands. His knees trembled. The man stepped closer, checking the card against the numbers chalked on the board. Suppose he had made a mistake. The pomade on the man's hair made him feel faint, and he backed away. But the man was checking the card over the microphone now, and he had to stay. He stood tense, listening. "Under the O, 44, the man chanted. "Under the I, 7. "Under the G, 3. "Under the B, 96. "Under the N, 13. His breath came easier as the man smiled at the audience. "Yes, sir, ladies and gentlemen, he's one of the chosen people." The audience rippled with laughter and applause. "Step right up to the front of the stage." He moved slowly forward, wishing that the light was not so bright. To win tonight's jackpot of $36.90, the wheel must stop between the double zero, understand? He nodded, knowing the ritual from the many days and nights he had watched the winners march across the stage to press the button that controlled the spinning wheel and receive the prizes. And now he followed the instructions as though he'd crossed the slippery stage 1,000,000 prize-winning times. The man was making some kind of a joke, and he nodded vacantly. So tense had he become that he felt a sudden desire to cry and shook it away. He felt vaguely that his whole life was determined by the bingo wheel. Not only that which would happen now that he was at last before it, but all that had gone before, since his birth and his mother's birth and the birth of his father. It had always been there, even though he had not been aware of it, handing out the unlucky cards and numbers of his days. The feeling persisted, and he started quickly away. "I better get down from here before I make a fool of myself," he thought. "Here, boy," the man called. "You haven't started yet." Someone laughed as he went hesitantly back. "Are you all reet?" He grinned at the man's jive talk, but no words could come, and he knew it was not a convincing grin. For suddenly he knew that he stood on the slippery brink of some terrible embarrassment. "Where are you from, boy?" the man asked. "Down south." "He's from down south, ladies and gentlemen," the man said. "Where from? Speak right into the mic." "Rocky Mount," he said. "Rocky Mount, North Carolina." "So you decided to come down off that mountain to the U.S.," the man laughed. He felt that the man was making a fool of him, but then something cold was placed in his hand and the lights were no longer behind him. Standing before the wheel, he felt alone, but that was somehow right, and he remembered his plan. He would give the wheel a short, quick twirl, just a touch of the button. He had watched it many times, and always it came close to a double zero when it was short and quick. He steeled himself. The fear had left, and he felt a profound sense of promise, as though he were about to be repaid for all the things he suffered all his life. Trembling, he pressed the button. There was a whirl of lights, and in a second he realized with finality that though he wanted to, he could not stop. It was as though he held a high-powered line in his naked hand. His nerves tightened. As the wheel increased its speed, it seemed to draw him more and more into its power, as though it held his fate, and with it came a deep need to submit, to whirl, to lose himself in its swirl of color. He could not stop it now, he knew. So let it be. The button rested snugly in his palm where the man had placed it, and now he became aware of the man beside him advising him through the microphone, while behind the shadowy audience hummed with noisy voices. He shifted his feet. There was still that feeling of helplessness within him, making part of him desire to turn back, even now that the jackpot was right in his hand. He squeezed the button until his fist ached. Then, like the sudden shriek of a subway whistle, a doubt tore through his head. Suppose he did not spin the wheel long enough? What could he do, and how could he tell? And then he knew, even as he wondered, that as long as he pressed the button, he could control the jackpot. He and only he could determine whether or not it was to be his. Not even the man with the microphone could do anything about it now. He felt drunk. Then, as though he had come down from a high hill into a valley of people, he heard the audience yelling, "Come down from there, you jerk! Let somebody else have a chance!" Old Jack thinks he done found the end of the rainbow. The last voice was not unfriendly, and he turned and smiled dreamily into the yelling mouse. Then he turned his back squarely on them. "Don't take too long, boy," a voice said. He nodded. They were yelling behind him. Those folks did not understand what had happened to him. They had been playing the bingo game day in and night out for years, trying to win rent money or hamburger change. But not one of those wise guys had discovered this wonderful thing. He watched the wheel whirling past the numbers and experienced a burst of exultation. "This is God! This is really, truly God!" He said it aloud. "This is God!" He said it with such absolute conviction that he feared he would fall fainting into the footlights. But the crowd yelled so loud that they could not hear. "Those fools," he thought. "I'm here trying to tell them the most wonderful secret in the world, and they're yelling like they're gone crazy." A hand fell upon his shoulder. "You'll have to make a choice now, boy. You've taken too long." He brushed the hand violently away. "Leave me alone, man. I know what I'm doing." The man looked surprised and held on to the microphone for support. And because he did not wish to hurt the man's feelings, he smiled, realizing with a sudden pang that there was no way of explaining to the man just why he had to stand there pressing the button forever. "Come here," he called tiredly. The man approached, rolling the heavy microphone across the stage. "Anybody can play this bingo game, right?" he said. "Sure, but..." He smiled, feeling inclined to be patient with this slick-looking white man with his blue sports shirt and his sharp gabardine suit. "That's what I thought," he said. "Anybody can win the jackpot as long as they get the lucky number, right? That's the rule, but after all..." "That's what I thought," he said. "And the big prize goes to the man who knows how to win it?" The man nodded speechlessly. "Well then, go on over there and watch me win like I want to. I ain't going to hurt nobody," he said, "and I'll show you how to win. I mean to show the whole world how it's got to be done." And because he understood, he smiled again to let the man know that he held nothing against him for being white and impatient. Then he refused to see the man any longer and stood pressing the button, the voices of the crowd reaching him like sounds in distant streets. Let them yell. All the Negroes down there were just ashamed because he was black like them. He smiled inwardly, knowing how it was. Most of the time he was ashamed of what Negroes did himself. Well, let them be ashamed for something this time, like him. He was like a long, thin black wire that was being stretched and wound upon the bingo wheel, wound until he wanted to scream, wound, but this time himself controlling the winding and the sadness and the shame. And because he did, Laura would be all right. Suddenly the lights flickered. He staggered backwards. Had something gone wrong? All this noise. Didn't they know that although he controlled the wheel, it also controlled him, and unless he pressed the button forever and forever and ever, it would stop, leaving him high and dry, dry and high on this hard, slippery hill, and Laura dead? There was only one chance. He had to do whatever the wheel demanded, and gripping the button in despair, he discovered with surprise that it imparted a nervous energy. His spine tingled. He felt a certain power. Now he faced a raging crowd with defiance, its screams penetrating his eardrums like trumpets shrieking from a jukebox. The vague faces glowing in the bingo lights gave him a sense of himself that he had never known before. He was running the show, by God. They had to react to him, for he was their luck. "This is me," he thought. "Let the bastards yell." Then someone was laughing inside him, and he realized that somehow he had forgotten his own name. It was a sad, lost feeling to lose your name, and a crazy thing to do. That name had been given him by the white man who had owned his grandfather a long, lost time ago down south. But maybe those wise guys knew his name. "Who am I?" he screamed. "Hurry up and bingo, you jerk!" They didn't know either, he thought sadly. They didn't even know their own names. They were all poor, nameless bastards. Well, he didn't need that old name. He was reborn. For as long as he pressed the button, he was the man who pressed the button, who held the prize, who was the king of bingo. That was the way it was, and he'd have to press the button even if nobody understood, even though Laura did not understand. "Live!" he shouted. The audience quieted like the dying of a huge fan. Live, Laura, baby! I got a hold of it now, sugar! Live! He screamed it, tears streaming down his face. I got nobody but you! The screams tore from his very guts. He felt as though the rush of blood to his head would burst out in baseball seams of small red droplets, like a head beaten by police clubs. Bending over, he saw a trickle of blood splashing the toe of his shoe. With his free hand, he searched his head. It was his nose. God, suppose something had gone wrong. He felt that the whole audience had somehow entered him and was stamping its feet in his stomach, and he was unable to throw them out. They wanted the prize, that was it. They wanted the secret for themselves. But they'd never get it. He would keep the bingo wheel whirling forever, and Laura would be safe in the wheel. But would she? It had to be, because if she were not safe, the wheel would cease to turn. It could not go on. He had to get away, vomit all. And his mind formed an image of himself running with Laura in his arms down the tracks of the subway just ahead of an A train, running desperately, vomit, with people screaming for him to come out, but knowing no way of leaving the tracks, because to stop would bring the train crushing down upon him, and to attempt to leave across the other tracks would mean to run into a hot third rail as high as his waist, which threw blue sparks that blinded his eyes until he could hardly see. He heard singing, and the audience was clapping its hands. Shoot the liquor to him, Jim boy! Clap, clap, clap! Well, call of the cop, he's blowing his top! Shoot the liquor to him, Jim boy! Bitter anger grew within him at the singing. They think I'm crazy! Well, let them laugh. I'll do what I got to do. He was standing in an attitude of intense listening when he saw that they were watching something on the stage behind him. He felt weak, but when he turned, he saw no one. If only his thumb did not ache so. Now they were applauding, and for a moment he thought that the wheel had stopped. But that was impossible. His thumb still pressed the button. Then he saw them. Two men in uniform beckoned from the end of the stage. They were coming toward him, walking in step, slowly, like a tap dance team returning for a third encore. But their shoulders shot forward, and he backed away, looking wildly about. There was nothing to fight them with. He had only the long black cord which led to a plug somewhere backstage, and he couldn't use that because it operated the bingo wheel. He backed slowly, fixing the men with his eyes as his lips stretched over his teeth in a tight, fixed grin, moved toward the end of the stage, and realizing that he couldn't go much further, for suddenly the cord became taut and he couldn't afford to break the cord. But he had to do something. The audience was howling. Suddenly he stopped dead, seeing the men halt, their legs lifted as in an interrupted step of a slow-motion dance. There was nothing to do but run in the other direction, and he dashed forward, slipping and sliding. The men fell back, surprised. He struck out violently, going past. Grab him! He ran, but all too quickly the cord tightened resistingly, and he turned and ran back again. This time he slipped them and discovered by running in a circle before the wheel he could keep the cord from tightening. But this way he had to flail his arms to keep the men away. Why couldn't they leave a man alone? He ran, circling. Ring down the curtain, someone yelled. But they couldn't do that. If they did, the wheel flashing from the projection room would be cut off. But they had him before he could tell them so, trying to pry open his fist, and he was wrestling and trying to bring his knees into the fight and holding on to the button, for it was his life. And now he was down, seeing a foot coming down, crushing his wrist cruelly, down as he saw the wheel whirling serenely above. "I can't give it up!" he screamed. Then quietly, in a confidential tone, "Boys, I really can't give it up." It landed hard against his head, and in the blank moment they had it away from him completely now. He fought them, trying to pull him up from the stage as he watched the wheel spin slowly to a stop. Without surprise, he saw it rest at 00. "You see?" he pointed bitterly. "Sure, boy, sure, it's okay," one of the men said, smiling. And seeing the man bow his head to someone he could not see, he felt very, very happy. He would receive what all the winners received. But as he warmed in the justice of the man's tight smile, he did not see the man's slow wink, nor see the bow-legged man behind him step clear of the swiftly descending curtain and set himself for a blow. He only felt the dull pain exploding in his skull, and he knew, even as it slipped out of him, that his luck had run out on the stage. And that story was King of the Bingo Game by Ralph Ellison, from the Treasury of American Short Stories, edited by Nancy Sullivan. And now from Pushcart Prize, Volume 37 from the year 2013, edited by Bill Henderson. I look at a photograph by Adam Zagajewski. I look at a photograph of the city where I was born, at its lush gardens and winding streets, at the hills, the Catholic roofs, the domes of Orthodox churches, where on Sunday the basses sing so mightily that neighboring trees sway as in a hurricane. I gaze at the photograph, I can't tear my eyes away, and suddenly I imagine that they're all still alive, as if nothing had happened. They still scurry to lectures, wait for trains, take sky-blue trams, check calendars with alarm, step on scales, listen to Verdi's arias and their favorite operetta, read newspapers that are still white, live in haste, in fear, are always late, are a bit immortal but don't know it. One's behind with the rent and another fears consumption. A third can't finish his thesis on Kant, doesn't understand what things are in themselves. My grandmother still goes to Bergecotista carrying a cake on her outstretched arms, and they don't droop. In the pharmacy, a shy boy requests a cure for shyness. A girl examines her small breasts in a mirror. My cousin goes to the park straight from his bath and doesn't guess that soon he'll catch pneumonia. Enthusiasm erupts at times. In winter, yellow lamps create cozy circles. In July, flies loudly celebrate the summer's great light and hum twilight hymns. Pogroms occur, uprisings, deportations, the cruel Wehrmacht in becoming uniforms, the foul NKVD invades, red stars promise friendship but signify betrayal, but they don't see it, they almost don't see it, they have so much to do, they need to lay up coal for winter, find a good doctor, the unanswered letters grow, the brown ink fades, a radio plays in the room, their latest buy, but they're still wearied by ordinary life and death. They don't have time. They apologize. They write long letters and laconic postcards. They're always late, hopelessly late. The same as us, exactly like us, like me. And that was I Look at a Photograph by Adam Zagajewski from Pushcart Prize, Volume 37 from the year 2013, edited by Bill Henderson. And that's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. If you miss a program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can also listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me, and bye for now.